With the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Taylor Hillman.
Good Tuesday morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. Looks like the rain has held off for the most part in most areas, besides some sprinkling overnight between Saturday and this morning. Coastal areas saw a little bit more rain than the valleys did. That forecasted storm that was supposed to be coming in from Hawaii really seemed to dissipate, never come around to forming up. But there is another one on the way that we talked about yesterday. This one's coming down a little bit more from the north. Meteorologists are forecasting rain all week for a good portion of the state. It looks to be a little bit more substantial than the last one, although these are the same forecasters who did forecast the last one. So we shall see. Temperatures are supposed to drop as well. We've seen some unseasonably warm temperatures, upper 60s on the coast, low 70s in many valley areas, and even 80s down south. But that's definitely going to change. I'm seeing high 50s on the coast, low 60s in the valleys, and as this storm moves down the state this week, even seeing high 50s as a high in Riverside County. Of course, as always, we will definitely take the rain here in California. Now let's get to today's news. The Sites Reservoir Project in the Sacramento Valley, one of 11 projects trying to secure Prop 1 funding to build more surface water storage, officially resubmitted their application for funding. The California Water Commission stated last month that all 11 of the projects showed well under the required public or environmental benefits that are written into the proposition. Western Agricultural Processors Association issued a release stating that the Sites Project Authority met with the Water Commission after that report to find out how they could improve their application's public benefit score. The commission developed an equation for applicants to use to grade their public benefit value. Each project was also offered recommendations to improve their score in the response letters to their original application. WAPA said the Sites Project Authority was able to resubmit their application with a score of 1.9. That's an improvement from the Water Commission's deemed 0.4 score that was originally given. The improvement was by showing substantial environmental benefits to salmon and Delta smelt. The deadline to resubmit applications was February 23rd. WAPA stated the commission is expected to respond to applicants in the next couple of months, with new official total scores expected in June. Now here's Brian German with more from WAPA's president about proposed regulations.
Cal/OSHA is proposing new indoor heat illness regulations as well as making adjustments to the existing outdoor heat illness standards. Packing houses, farm shops, haulers, and processors would all be subject to the new regulations. President and CEO of Western Agricultural Processors Association, Roger Isom, noted what this would mean for ag operations and their labor force.
If you can afford to put in air conditioning and fan systems and that would cool it down to a temperature that's acceptable, maybe you could do it, but what does that cost? We don't know. Others just simply won't be able to do it, and they'll find ways to automate everything, which has been the trend. So again, it comes back to the activists trying to say that they're protecting the workers and that are actually making it worse and are going to eliminate those jobs when there isn't even a problem. 100-something here during the summer, and we get acclimated to that, and we put fans in, we open up the windows, we do what we can, and we haven't seen a problem.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
True almond damage from the freezing temperatures experienced in February is still unknown. YARA's Director of Agronomy Services for the Western United States, Steve Petrie, says we likely won't know until the end of the season, if at all. Petrie says it's important for producers to not give up on the season, as trees can shift resources to where they need to go. And it's even possible that growers won't see a weight difference in their final yield. Steve, we've had freezing temperatures as of late. There are still some cold storms coming through. I don't think we're going to see really cold temperatures coming up, but what have you seen and heard from the industry? What kind of damage are we looking at?
Well, certainly we've seen variable damage throughout the entire Central Valley from north to south. We've seen variation in damage within regions within the valley. We see damage from variations from one farm to the next and even within one orchard. And so it's extremely difficult at this point to know what the ultimate effect of this freeze is going to have on the final yield.
that's kind of the message we have been talking about this week is it's going to depend. We're not going to know how much damage is out there, and we really need to wait. There's a lot of bloom time left. It seems like these temperatures have slowed down the tree a little bit. And also, these trees compensate a little bit as far as pushing carbohydrates. You mentioned something pretty interesting about the physiology of the tree, about how we may see weight be normal at the end of the year. I mean, that's a possibility.
It's certainly a possibility that the trees that have suffered some damage will have internal compensation mechanisms and so forth, and allow that tree to achieve nearly normal yields, depending again on the amount of damage that it's had in this frost. The real key message, I think, is that we don't want to lose heart. We want to continue to manage these orchards, the irrigation management, the pest management, and the nutrient management, for the yield potential that that crop truly has. And the only way to know that will be to get out and scout those orchards, monitor them, know what the yield potential is, and then be sure to manage to achieve that potential through, again, optimum fertilizer management, pest management, and all the other inputs that we have control over, so that we get the best possible yield that we can have.
Yeah, and that has been a similar message from advisors in the state as well. And also, it's important that you're setting this tree up for next season here coming up in a few months too. So, and that's important as well.
Well, exactly. The yield that tree will have in 2019 begins to be determined by the nutritional status and other factors in May and June of 2018. So again, I encourage growers to get out in their orchards, actually see what the damage is, monitor those trees, and then manage them to the best of their ability to get the highest possible yield they can this year and set the stage for optimum yield and quality next year.
You and I both discussed it can be disheartening as a grower to see some of that damage, but it's one of those things where we just got to kind of push forward and see how the season ends up.
Exactly. And again, pay attention to the crop. The individual growers know their trees, know their groves and orchards, and spend time out there, see what's really going on. And then again, continue to stress, manage for the best possible yield given what nature has given us.
This is Farm City Newsday by Agnet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Agnet West's Farm City Newsday. More agriculture news for you now.
McKellar Family Farms in Tulare County is setting aside specific times to allow families and small groups to experience a wagon ride farm tour as part of their efforts to educate the community on agricultural production. The farm is home to over 180 acres of citrus. Social media and marketing coordinator for McKellar Family Farms, Kelly Lapadula, talked about their spring break farm tours scheduled for March 27th and 28th.
We're planning during the week of spring break. Since typically we only do large group tours, during spring break we offer individual tours for small families or groups who are on vacation and want to be able to see the farm. So we're going to have a couple days that week set up where people can schedule their tour to see the wagon tour. And we'll have updates on our social media about that. So if people want to follow us on McKellar Family Farms, that's where we'll keep all that information as the event approaches.
I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
Well, in today's livestock news, newly elected president-elect of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, Jennifer Houston from Sweetwater, Tennessee, recently talked about a variety of issues, including ELDs, electronic logging devices, an issue she said that is crucial for many cattle producers.
It's crucial. As a market operator in Tennessee, it's crucial for us, but interestingly enough, it's crucial for basically the rest of the country except for the beef belt. You know, our 90-day extension is going to run out on March 18th. We're working for a multi-year extension. People understand we've got to have some relief, that we can't deal with this, so we hope we're going to get this multi-year extension to give us time to really dive in and see what a workable solution is to the hours of service. it's the hours of service is our problem, but it's just going to be exacerbated by having to use the electronic logging devices.
Obviously, we're hearing from a lot of folks about this, and it's not just the cattle industry. I mean, there are other folks also working on this.
There are. I think with anybody that transports live animals like we do, I think it's the most crucial, too, because it's not only a safety thing, it's an animal welfare issue. And we have to keep that in mind, too, as we talk about what possible solutions are.
But Houston wants producers to know whether it's ELDs or any other issue like this, they do have a great staff in Washington, D.C. taking care of those.
I want everybody to know that, you know, we just have a fantastic staff at NCBA. And while we're all back home and doing our thing and, you know, raising our cattle and planting our field and doing our hay jobs, they're out there working for us every day. And we've just had a very positive year with a lot of wins on Capitol Hill. And the wins on Capitol Hill translate into better able to do your business at home, keeping the government out of our business, whether you're on public lands, whether you're back east like I am. And so I just want our members and all cattle producers to know that, you know, we're working on your behalf every day so that you can do your job.
Again, that was NCBA President-elect Jennifer Houston. And USDA slightly reduced its projections for red meat and poultry production this year. The forecast is slightly lower than last month, primarily due to a drop in beef production, but that will more than offset increased pork and turkey production. The latest World Ag Supply and Demand Estimates report said broiler production remains unchanged. USDA sees lower cattle slaughter and weights, which will be offset by somewhat higher fed beef production and higher non-fed beef production the first half of this year. Pork production was lower through the first half of the year due to a slow slaughter pace, but production in the second half of 2018 is expected to increase thanks to higher expected carcass weights. Now, beef imports are forecast to be higher this year thanks to robust early year demand. No change, though, forecast for beef exports. The pork import forecast looks higher because of expected demand strength, but pork exports are also forecasted higher than they were last month. The quarterly hogs and pigs report coming out March 29th should give a clear picture of farrowing intentions over the next two quarters. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Everett Greiner is next.
Organic farming has become a well-known phrase in today's world. From its start a little more than a decade ago, it has grown continuously with more producers and more consumers. But now, we're learning that there are products being sold as organic that are not real. And before you get upset, it's mostly imported food products that do not meet the requirements of American-grown organics. Even if you have been fooled, Congress is working on a bill that would stop the import of these fake products. It isn't the law yet, but it's expected to be passed before this current session is over. Now, in the meantime, there's a way you can be satisfied that your organic food products are real. Ask if what you're buying is imported. If it is, leave it alone. And that's AgriView for today. Everett Greiner, AgNet West.
This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. I'm Taylor Hillman. In today's interview segment, the director of Food Evolution, the film that explores the debate about genetically modified organisms, was at Commodity Classic recently in Anaheim. Scott Hamilton Kennedy talked with our AgWired friends for their recent Smart Farmer podcast. Here's ZimCom's Jamie Johansson.
Scott, who are you? Tell us about yourself.
Sure. I'm a filmmaker, a journalist, a father, a citizen of the United States and of the planet, I guess. How's that? And yeah, I like to consider myself as a filmmaker, both a communicator, a journalist, but a storyteller. I mean, even as a documentarian, my definition of documentary is an adaptation of the truth. And some people might blanch at that and go, what do you mean by adaptation? It's the truth. You can't adapt in it. But of course it's an adaptation. We choose things all the time. I choose what subject I want to follow. I choose the people I want to follow. I choose if I'm going to put music in it or not. So we're all making these decisions as storytellers. The question is, are we doing it and still trying to tell the truth, right? And my adaptation of the truth, or are we trying to manipulate the truth to our ends? So I work very, very hard to try and tell the full nuanced truth.
The Institute for Food Technologists, IFT, wanted to celebrate their 75th anniversary, and their goal was to create a film to educate awareness of the 9 billion population and our growing need to feed that growing population. Take me through how you got into that mix.
Sure. So IFT approached a bunch of documentarians like myself and said, yes, we'd like to make a film looking at the screaming population from about 7.2 billion to 9 billion by 2050. How are we going to feed those people safely, sustainably, nutritiously? And that's too big of a subject for an individual film, but I went away and I researched with my producing partner, Trey Sheehan, and we found the GMO controversy, the GMO story and controversy to be incredibly interesting, to be very timely, to be have issues that are first world and third world. Obviously, it's about food and science. And probably most interestingly as a storyteller is it wasn't being told correctly. So we had the opportunity to reset this conversation and reset it through the lens of science. Some people may try to call this film a pro-GMO film, and that's a fine from a certain point of view, but we didn't make the film to make a pro-GMO film. We made the film to make a pro-science film and to make a film that helps us make good decisions and lowers fear-mongering. So that's how we came to deciding to make the film, and I've been really proud with the response to it, and it still seems to be growing.
Well, you said something very interesting there, pro-science, and I'm an agriculturalist. I've born and raised in the industry my entire life, but now I get to tell the story of the industry and the industry that I love. But this was the first time that GMOs were told and researched from a scientific perspective instead of just an agriculture and farming background. So kind of explain your research that you as an independent party came in knowing that you just wanted to produce the science.
Yeah, we did a great deal of research on this film. We did over 200 Skype interviews just for research. They didn't end up in the film, just for research. And as we tried to follow a very simple rule of trying to talk to the smartest people on all sides of the conversation. People that would consider themselves pro-GMO, anti-GMO, but most importantly, let's go look at the scientific studies that were done. And there's thousands of them that have been done by the same organizations that have helped us come to understand and respect that climate change is real, have also told us that the current GMOs on the market are safe for ourselves and safe for the environment, case by case basis going forward. So that's really what gave us the confidence to say that GMOs are safe for ourselves and safe for the planet. So yeah, just a lot of research looking at this as independent journalists and trying to tell the full nuanced truth.
So let's dive into the movie. Take me through, you know, beyond the research and that kind of, take me through the fun part of putting it together, sure. Kind of the stories that you were able to tell, the people you were able to meet across the country.
Sure. One of the big inspirations for the film was came about through the two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Amy Harmon from the New York Times, her series on the GMO controversy in Hawaii. So Hawaii, some politicians in Hawaii were trying to ban all GMOs, and that sounded sort of interesting and controversial at first. They didn't have a lot of science. Worse than not having a lot of science, they were pulling in some terrible anti-GMO people like Jeffrey Smith as experts, quote-unquote experts, saying terrifying things like GMOs can increase your chance of getting HIV, which A, is untrue and isn't even the way that HIV, as we all know, isn't the way that HIV is even transferred. So just terrible people like that. And then to make it even more interesting, the papaya industry was saved by a GMO papaya called the rainbow papaya. And to take that one step further, this is just the Hawaii section of the film, those same politicians said, oh, that's okay, we want to ban all GMO. And then somebody pointed out that the GMO papaya saved the papaya industry. And they go, oh, that's okay, we'll grandfather that in. And I said, well, what are you saying? They didn't even realize that just undercut their own argument. And with that, I, as a storyteller, I was like, well, that's a good story. So that's basically the first act. That's like the setup for the whole story. And then we found stories like the rainbow papaya. Then we also found stories going all the way to Africa, Kenya, and Uganda, where they have a terrible virus called banana wilt that's wiped out over 50% of bananas in Africa, and there's a GMO fix for that. And we followed that story, and it can't be brought to farmers yet mostly because of antis trying to fight against it and not allowing it to get to the market. So many stories like that, finding incredible science communicators like Alice Van Eenemann at UC Davis, Mark Linus, who was is an environmentalist and was an anti-GMO activist who changed his mind and because of science became a pro-GMO activist. So some really fascinating people.
You brought up the international issue because, you know, in the U.S. we talk about our own issues, but globally the problems that GMO solves, but it also the problems internationally that they bring to the table, especially the European Union and their regulatory issues with anti-GMO. How can this film internationally bring the story and the science to the forefront?
Well, it's obviously going to be from people seeing the film, and we are very proud of the fact it hasn't even been out yet for a year. This June will be out for a year, and that's only theatrically, and then it went digitally in September, so it still feels like it's only growing. They have to see the film, and we've been very proud of the way that it's been used on universities. It's been used from people on the political realm that can make those political decisions to see the film and open a conversation about using science to make good decisions. As Neil deGrasse Tyson said at the premiere of the film, if we're not using science to make decisions, that's the end of an informed democracy. So again, the film, while it is a defense of resetting the conversation on GMOs, at the end of the day, it's a pro-science film. It is about the importance of using science to make decisions in agriculture and so many other decisions that we need to make every day.
This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from around the state and the nation at our website, agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West's Farm City Newsday. More agriculture news for you now. Christine Snowden of Iowa is one of the 2018 Pig Farmers of Tomorrow. Snowden has a diverse background, but is fully committed to the swine industry.
I am originally from Johnstown, Ohio. I moved out to Audubon, Iowa for my career path in swine. So I kind of fell in love with pigs when I was in 4-H, and just moving through that process and getting to raise those animals, I chose a education in that at Ohio State in animal sciences, really focusing on swine. And then when it was time to get a career, I chose to start working with AMBC as a person inside their sow farms. So I started in their leadership development program, and now I have graduated out of that program, and I am an assistant farrowing manager at a 6,200-head sow farm.
Snowden has an important story to tell.
Especially for my generation, in getting to know where your food comes from, because we are so removed from the farm, unfortunately, just making sure that they know that my career is just as rewarding a career path, and I also get to work with animals every day, and I get to have the sense of pride knowing that I am putting a safe product on the plate of consumers, and they get to enjoy that every day.
The Ohio native appreciates her collegiate training and her hands-on experience she's gained on the farm.
You get that technical learning at school and get to learn different stuff, but then you get the hands-on and get to put what you learned in the classroom into my everyday. And I think for some people, they think that in my generation, we think of ourselves as, okay, I got this college education, now I want this huge job, instead of taking a step back and really getting to see it firsthand and work inside of a sow farm and getting to see those piglets and then moving our way up, even though we have that educational background.
The Agriculture Secretary appreciates flexibilities given to some U.S. trading partners within recently announced tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. Rod Bain has more.
Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue admits he felt like many in the farm sector as they awaited President Donald Trump's recent announcement.
I was very anxious about the announced aluminum steel tariffs as far as it relates to agriculture, and still am to some degree.
Secretary Perdue, talking to reporters in North Dakota, says, however, in terms of the president's announcement of a 25% tariff on steel imports and 10% tariff on aluminum imports and flexibilities built in for specific nations.
I'm grateful, frankly, and we've worked for the flexibility to make sure Canada and Mexico during these NAFTA negotiations were not included, as well as another door to say, EU, come, let's talk.
as well as individual Asian countries. And while some ag interests wonder about retaliatory tariffs against U.S. farm and food exports, the secretary points to an additional concern.
Everything you do with agriculture touches steel. All this equipment, and from the cost standpoint of production, is one threat. We have to be concerned about that.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Now recapping our top story.
Cal OSHA is proposing new indoor heat illness regulations as well as making adjustments to the existing outdoor heat illness standards. President and CEO of Western Agricultural Processors Association, Roger Isom, noted what this would mean for ag operations and their labor force.
If you can afford to put in air conditioning and fan systems and that would cool it down to a temperature that's acceptable, maybe you could do it, but what does that cost? We don't know. Others just simply won't be able to do it, and they'll find ways to automate everything, which has been the trend. So again, it comes back to the activists trying to say that they're protecting the workers and that are actually making it worse and are going to eliminate those jobs when there isn't even a problem. 100-something here during the summer, and we get acclimated to that, and we put fans in, we open up the windows, we do what we can, and we haven't seen a problem.
To get more information on topics you've heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also follow AgNet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgNet West. Follow Brian German @BrianAgNetWest and Taylor Hillman @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City Newsday by AgNet West.